Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready. Your argument is FSP operator.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Russell McMaine, along with co-counsel Greg Simpson and Mike Hatchell represent FFP Operating Partners. In this case involving a recovery under the Graham Shop Act submission in the court resulting in somewhat $40-plus million judgment solely directed against the alcohol provider, which the Court of Appeals in our contentions briefly summarized, erroneously affirmed the trial court's summary judgment and its erroneous charge based on the claimed inapplicability of the Texas Comparative Responsibility Statute.
Let me ask you this. Let's say it applies. The trial court erred in not submitting the driver's negligence.
Okay.
And the jury apportions the driver's negligence.
Yes.
Isn't the provider then still responsible for the driver's negligence?
No.
Now, the statute says liable for the actions of their customers. How do you get around that?
And because the statute also said that it does not impose any greater liability than is required by the statute. And the statute requires that there actually be a submission and determination.
I understand, but to me those are two different things. There's the submission of, there's the apportionment, which I can understand scenarios where that could make a difference in a case. But you'd have to admit there's some vicarious element here, or direct liability. Then what is liable for
not
the
in vicarious liability. There is
I understand not vicarious, direct liability, let's call it. But
there is direct liability.
There is direct liability.
There is direct statutory liability under the statute. What is imputed is causation. That's what this court held in Stake and Hale versus Bornemann.
I'm not sure I understand. Liable for the actions of their customer means that they are not liable for the driver's negligence?
And you see, driver's negligence is not pertinent to the actual statute. Driver's intoxication must be a proximate cause in order to define, in order to impute causation. But there is no requirement under the statute to submit the driver's negligence. There is a requirement to submit the specific components of the claim under the statutory dram shop provisions against the provider.
But I'm confused as to what the language that you are liable for the actions of your customer, what that means, if it doesn't mean you're liable.
That's just general abstract language. It can't possibly mean that it is vicariously liable. Only the idea that you can justify the non-submission and the limitations with regards to joint and several liability that are imposed by the comparative responsibility statute.
I'm not arguing about the submission. I'm saying, let's say that it needs to be submitted.
Well, of course, it does have an effect on the judgment.
Well, I still don't understand. Even if a certain percentage is apportioned to the driver, it still seems to me as though the language of the statute requires that the provider pay the driver's portion.
No, I don't believe that's true, Your
Honor. Then what do you think that language means? Liable for the actions of the
What that means is actually consistent with what the court had said that it means, which is that in Houston versus Love, citing Section 203 of the Act, that this chapter is in lieu of any other law and says this chapter does not impose obligations on a provider of alcoholic beverages other than those expressly stated in this chapter. It does not expressly state that they are vicariously liable for the negligence. Vicarious liability is not mentioned in the statute.
I'm not asking that. I'm asking, what does the language mean, liable for the actions of the customer?
What it means is it is a basis through which proximate cause can be established against the provider. That basically does nothing but represent the legislative determination that establishing that the intoxication of the driver or the intoxication of the individual customer was in fact a proximate cause is all that is necessary. It doesn't require that there be negligence even or a negligence determination on the part of the driver. It's not an imputation of liability. It's an imputation of causation only. It's designed to meet the causal nexus.
Even though it says liable.
Certainly. Because it's the statute, the entire purpose of the statute is to say, this is the only liability that you can have.
But another purpose of the statute is to protect people from drunk drivers and put the onus of providing that protection on the provider, irrespective of the driver's negligence. one purpose of the statute?
One purpose of the statute is to protect people, including the drunk himself, as this court said in Smith versus Sewell.
And making the provider liable for the customer's actions would promote that purpose.
And again, they are liable, but only under the conditions in the statute. That is, they must have sold to an obviously intoxicated individual as a prerequisite to liability. They're not liable for all negligence that has nothing to do with their intoxication. They're only liable insofar as that aspect of the liability is submitted. There isn't even a requirement to submit the negligence to the driver, and he was, of course, not submitted in this case over our strenuous objection. This does not impose vicarious liability. It imposes causation or imputes causation because the legislature...
You're saying not damages. The provider's not liable for the driver's percentage of the damages awarded.
No. Not in terms of whatever that percentage, however that percentage allocation would work out. No. Because the comparative responsibility statute, assuming as you started with your question, applies. It says that we shall be liable. Any person submitted under the comparative responsibility statute is liable only for the percentage determined by the jury, unless they're more than 50%, in which case they're jointly and severally liable. There is absolutely no basis for taking the position that we're going to impose joint and several liability. That would enhance the obligations of an alcohol provider, directly contrary to the provisions of the statute itself in Chapter 2.
So if the jury found the driver was 90% negligent, or apportioned 90% on the driver and 10% on the provider only has to pay the 10%.
Correct. That's precisely the...
I see how that promotes liable for the actions of the customer. That seems to fly in the face of the plain language.
Your Honor, well, the plain language of the statute is that they shall be liable only in accordance with the statute. And the liability issues were, in fact, submitted in this case. They were the liability of the providers with regards to their conduct. And it's only a regulation of their conduct. And what the thing actually says is that the duties owed are only as provided in this chapter. And that duty does not in any way relate or implicate to vicarious liability. Word vicarious liability is nowhere mentioned in here. When the comparative responsibility statute was amended in 1995, it specifically had the same language with regards to the comparative responsibility provisions in it and the percentage of responsibility determinations in it. It was broadened to include all torts of any kind universally, with the exception of two that don't have any application here. One was exemplary damages and workers' compensation type cases. Other than in those two cases, the comparative responsibility statute applies, period. Liability is determined under Chapter 33, 011, 12, and 13, based on the percentages assessed by the jury. And it is an attempt to exonerate and exclude joint and several liability, except in the one situation where their individual is more than 50% at fault. And in that situation, then there is joint and several liability imposed. Then there are a couple of others in relation to toxic torts, which, of course, have no application. But apart from that, there is, in fact, no basis whatsoever for imposing joint and several liability. That would expand the liability of the provider beyond the specific limitations of Chapter 2, which say that you can't expand it any further, that this is all the duty that is owed. The only real issue, and that's just an isolated segment of the statute. The actual applicable part is the statute is, this is what the statute said in Section 2.01 et cetera. Is that the statute says that he shall not provide alcohol to a person, a customer, or whatever, a licensee under the statute, shall not provide alcohol to a person who is obviously intoxicated. Those elements have to be submitted. What those elements are the basis of liability are established by this court in Borner. And their responsibility shall not be expanded beyond those duties. It is the issue of duty that is dealt with, not any kind of imposition of vicarious liability. There is no justification for holding that. It's not conceivably consistent with Smith versus Sue, because If, in fact, the liability that were imposed were, quote, purely vicarious, there could never be a recovery by the individual who is intoxicated. Principles of circuitous indemnity would preclude it, because we would be entitled to, under, in fact, the Court of Appeals' express determination, while it attempted to distinguish Smith versus Sewell on a rather strange basis, if, in fact, the interpretation were to be applied uniformly, that is argued by the plaintiffs in this case, then, in fact, it would make Smith versus Sewell wrongly decided. Smith versus Sewell specifically held, as a matter of fact, not limited, as was argued, but rather to the contrary, indicated that it was, in fact, universally applicable. The concluding part of the court's opinion in Smith versus Sewell is, because Chapter 2 clearly establishes a legal standard and creates a cause of action for conduct violative of that legal standard, and it's the legal standard that we were talking about, that definition of percentage of responsibility provides additional support for our determination that the Comparative Responsibility Act is applicable to Chapter 2 causes of action, period. Not Chapter 2 causes of action brought by the drunk itself only. This arbitrary attempt to distinguish between first party and third party type claims is silly on the face of the statute. It cannot be reconciled with the plain language of the statute. It violates virtually every conceivable statutory construction principle imaginable. They have to rewrite the statute to accomplish that result. Indemnity cannot be a justifiable basis for failing to submit the percentage responsibility issue. In this case, there cannot be an entitlement to indemnity. That, in fact, would militate against the principles that were intended by the statute, which was to make the providers potentially liable.
Let me ask you. Is it possible that Smith was wrong? Hard cases make bad law.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because Smith was based on two things. Number one is that the standard that we're talking about is that there must be some objectively verifiable perception, at least, that the person is obviously intoxicated such as to present a danger to himself or others. Statute was clearly designed to protect the drunk as well. Comparative responsibility statute language that exists in 95 is the same language that was interpreted by the court in Smith versus Sewell. And in terms of what the percentage of responsibility shall be submitted. And so it's the same language. It's the same basis for the whole.
My question is there a possibility that Smith would...
I don't
believe...
You
say you can't draw a distinction between Smith in this case on the language of the statute, but might Smith have been wrong? And the plaintiffs...
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, we don't believe that Smith was wrong, but it certainly could not be wrong in the context of trying to, in some way, allow, when this legislature changed in 1995, the Comparative Responsibility Statute, to specifically authorize the bringing of responsible third-party actions. So the question is, does the drunk have any potential liability to the plaintiffs in this case who caused the action? Yes, he does. If he does, he's a responsible third party.
The argument by the mothers against drunk driving is that one of the primary purposes of the Dram Shop Act was to provide deterrence, meaning that they wanted to deter dram shops from serving alcoholic beverages to people who go out and drive while they're drunk. Is there some basis to determine that Chapter 202 that creates the cause of action was designed to impose liability on the dram shop as a deterrent greater than tort actions generally provide a deterrent in that it requires the actor to pay for the damages they cause if they commit the
crime? We don't believe that there is. We think that actually the deterrence notion is the real thing that the passage of the Act and its application in terms of the specific requirements on causation What it does do is to basically say it doesn't matter that there is no proof, as in ordinary cases, that your additional intoxication or additional beverages necessarily enhanced the likelihood of there being an accident. So there is actually is an expansion of liability to the dram shop defendant that would not ordinarily be applicable in ordinary cases based on the imputation of causation that is provided in the statute. But that in no way, in no place could the Alcohol and Beverage Code, provisions in Chapter 2 or otherwise, support the notion that the statute was designed to insulate drunks from potential liability.
Well, but it seems to fit very
nicely. Or to require the entire risk shifting to the drunk from the dram shop defendant, which is what would be required in an indemnity context as held by the Court of Appeals.
Well,
there remains liability on the part of the dram shop provider, assuming that the findings are made by the jury.
Well, let's say I would agree with you that the indemnity piece doesn't quite fit here. But to me, not calling it vicarious liability, which gives you indemnity, but calling it direct liability that needs to be submitted sort of fits very neatly within what appears to be the purpose of the statute, and that is if it's supposed to be, if the driver's negligence is supposed to be submitted to the jury, and the jury finds, say, 30% negligence on the driver, and the dram shop is responsible for the driver's 30%, the dram shop can go against the driver for contribution, but not indemnity. So that seems to prove the purpose of the statute, and that is not to let the dram shop off the hook, but still to require the driver, if he can pay, to shoulder some of the responsibility, but if he can't, the dram shop seems to put the onus on the dram shop to take over.
Well, that, based on your Honor's hypothetical, the 70-30 split imposes joint and several liability anyway.
I understand that, and that's what I'm saying. It seems to me that if you go under that construct that it must be submitted under the comparative statute, but the dram shop is still is directly liable and can get contribution from the driver, if that is the construct that would apply here, then what the trial court did in this case would be harmless error.
No. Absolutely not. They granted summary judgment that the comparative responsibility statute did not apply. We are entitled to the attempt to defend against joint and several liability. The 1995 statute specifically says that we are entitled to that, and there is no legitimate basis whatsoever to interpret Chapter 33 any other way. Dram shop actions are not excluded from its application. The limitations on joint and several liability that are part and parcel of the 95 tort reform amendments to the comparative responsibility statute do not authorize the imposition of joint and several liability further than the statute applies generally, which is what, in essence, Your Honor is arguing.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents. May it please the court, Mr. John Burton, will present argument from respondents.
May it please the court, my co-counsels to my right, Krista Brown, also David Roberts from Port Lavaca, the attorney for the ad litem is here, as well as Mr. Oscar Villarreal from San Antonio, the author of the MAD brief that Justice O'Neill referenced. May it please the court, you now have before you the three authorities that govern this appeal. And Justice O'Neill's question to my opposing counsel is, what is the meaning on the of the authority that's on the left hand of the handout, which is Section 2.03 of the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Code, is very important.
Let me ask a question on that. Is 2.03 the statute we look to determine the nature of the cause of action against the dram shop?
It's the legislature's own description of that, so yes.
Well, but the description says that the liability under the chapter. So my question is 2.03 the provision that establishes the cause of action against the dram shop?
The elements, no. All that can be said, Justice Enoch, is that is the term the legislature used in describing its own scheme for governing providers of alcohol.
Okay, so you would agree that the provision that creates the cause of action against the dram shop is actually 2.02.
It is. Two
elements. 2.03 is simply a description by the legislature of what 2.02 was, just a description of what they were doing in 2.02.
Precisely.
So if we're going to find vicarious, if we're going to find that the dram shop was to be liable for the conduct of the drunk, then it has to appear in 2.02. Because 2.03 said that it is, there is no other claims against the dram shop except what was established by 2.02.
2.02 does no more and no less than tell the elements. The first element, they sell to an obviously intoxicated person to the extent they're dangerous.
But don't, doesn't, but 2.02 said you have a cause of action through these elements.
Precisely. Those are the two elements.
And 2.03 said you have no other cause of action except what's established in 2.02.
You are, but Your Honor is ignoring the legislature's description of what those two elements mean.
But the description is limited by the very cause of action that's created by 2.02, isn't it?
There's only two elements, and their description of those elements. And one of the elements don't have a cause and fact element between the sale and the crash. You follow what I'm saying? The elements are an illegal sale, and then the intoxication of the customer causes the crash, they're liable for that. They admit in their brief, on page 6 of their reply brief, they admit that we need innocent members of the public like the Duenas family don't have to show that the sale was a cause, a but-for cause, or a proximate cause of the crash. So 2.03, all it does is recognize precisely what Chapter 33 says, that they are liable for the acts of their customer because the dram shop has not caused the crash. Under the common law, that the drinking of alcohol was always the cause of the crash and not the sale of that alcohol. The legislature, with Mad's help, enacted a statute making the dram shop liable for the actions of its customers by leaving out a cause in fact element. And at least twice on page 6 of their reply brief, they concede that. On page 5, they concede we need not show that the sale was a proximate cause of the wreck. And on page 6, they admit we need not show that it even was a cause in fact.
So your argument is, by looking to 2.02, that's a clear expression by the legislature that this was not to be considered in conjunction with the proportionate responsibility statute.
Exactly. Because the middle statute on the handout, Chapter 33, tells us which parties are submitted in apportionment. And there's a big disconnect that we've had with Mr. McMaines. He's wasted half his brief on the argument that apportionment applies in dram shop cases. It certainly does. It will apply every time there is more than one cause of the crash. Here there is but one cause of the crash. That's the intoxication of the patron. And if we look very carefully at Article 33.011, the definition that the legislature has provided to us for percentage of responsibility is this: how much a person has caused or contributed to cause the harm for which damages are sought. We don't submit and ask juries to submit people who were not the cause of the crash. Just think.
The same argument could be made in Smith versus Sue.
Your Honor, if
like very simple.
Well, the parties didn't do the court any favors in Smith versus Sewell by citing the court to the language causing or contributing to cause. And more importantly, the court never discussed, and nobody asked the question, if the legislature has made providers liable for the actions of their customers, the obvious question is liable to whom? The answer is innocent third parties.
But it seems to me you have to argue Smith versus Sewell was wrong.
Oh, heavens no, Your Honor. And Smith versus Sewell, the court, I take disagreement with my opposing counsel in calling the distinction silly between innocent third parties and intoxicated people. I say that because this court, in the final paragraph of that opinion, did just that, Justice Hedlund.
Well, of course there are differences, but there's no difference in 202 and 203. You can see an obvious difference in that. If you're writing statutes, you might say, oh, yes, this will treat this one differently.
No argument there, Your Honor. The statutes have not been changed. But unfortunately, no help to the court. The parties were. They didn't brief, nor did the court discuss what 2.03 means as it relates to the nature of the liability.
Well, we can blame them. They're not here. But my question is, if 203 means what you say it does in this case, doesn't it mean the same thing as Smith versus Sewell?
Sure. Smith versus Sewell, had the court had the benefit of the briefing and been able to address Section 2.03, which it didn't in that first party case, as just Chief Justice Phillips, the Chief, said, sometimes bad facts can make bad law. But the court, it's a disservice to the court to say that the court was attempting to construe this statute for innocent third parties when the court, in the first paragraph of the opinion, states that it's limited to its facts. Second, in the opinion, it notes that its holding is limited to the unique circumstances present in the case. And then, of course, the last paragraph, which we think clearly makes it clear that the Smith court was not trying to interpret statutes not before it and arguments that were not before it when it says the statute was passed to deter the disastrous consequences of alcohol permit holders selling to people who are already intoxicated. But then the court goes around and says, but when it is the intoxicated patron suing his own provider, we think, by gosh, he ought to be responsible.
Let me ask you, what's wrong requiring a comparative submission? If there's some, I'm not going to use the word vicarious liability, if there is, the statute, as you read it, does provide direct liability for the customer's actions. What's wrong with submitting the customer's percentage of responsibility so that the dram shop can then go back and collect from the customer if they are deep pocket?
Well, the first impediment we have to that is the statute. Before a party can be submitted, they have to have caused or contributed to cause the crash. The dram shop under the statute is not a cause.
So it's your position if he put the beer in his trunk and didn't ever open a can of it, and he'd driven on the bridge, the dram provided the fast food place would still be liable.
I can do no better, Your Honor, than quote my opposing counsel
no,
says.
No, I'm not asking if that's your position or not.
It's our position and theirs. They've conceded that. That's exactly what it means. The legislature intended to draw a line that says to an alcohol permit holder, Justice Owen, when you sell to someone obviously intoxicated to the extent he's dangerous, we're not going to try to unscramble the egg and make an innocent member of the public show that obviously dangerous person got even drunker by the additional alcohol. That would render the statute virtually meaningless because the drunk is already so dangerous under the strict standard in 2.02 that it would be virtually impossible to ever get any answer other than the drunk caused the crash, because he did.
Can I go back to my question?
Yes.
Presume that we say that the comparative responsibility statute does apply, that we disagree with your premise. What would be wrong with that in this context? What would be wrong if you have a deep-pocket drunk driver who the jury finds is 80% responsible? What's wrong with putting liability on the provider but allowing them to get contribution from the drunk driver? What's wrong with that construct?
Well, the statute, number one, because the statute only permits people to be submitted who are a cause of the crash.
But let's presume, again, the premise of my question is we don't buy your argument on that, that we say the comparative responsibility still applies in terms of that. I'm just saying, what's wrong with the result? Why doesn't that fit every need? I mean, it allows some responsibility on the driver's part. And under your reading, the dram shop would be liable and could get nothing from the driver. Is that right?
I do not agree with that. Chapter 32 of the Civil Practices and Remedies Code has a contribution scheme that perhaps might allow the dram shop who paid a judgment to us to go get paid.
I guess what I'm saying is if you don't do the indemnity paradigm that vicarious liability produces, if you just did direct liability with contribution in this context, why doesn't that serve all purposes? Because then the provider's still liable for their own percentage of responsibility, which addresses the dram shop's, the statute's concern. The driver is responsible for their percentage of responsibility. The dram shop has to take over that piece of the responsibility if the driver can't pay it. But if the driver can, they bear the cost of their own negligence. So why doesn't it fit perfectly? And it includes joint and several liability and certain based on the percentages. I don't see why that would not be a reasonable construct.
I think if I'm understanding your question, it is a reasonable construct. Your question involves solely the relationship between the drunk and his own provider. Am I right?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Then I think your construct is perfectly fair. I want to try to be as clear as I can, and I apologize if I have not. We do not disagree that apportionment, Chapter 33, applies to dram shop cases but it only applies according to its terms. Once we agree that Chapter 33 applies to Article 2 of the Alcoholic Beverage Code, the next question that we have to ask is, who is submitted under Chapter 33? And they would like to be able to apportion between culpability, blameworthiness, egregiousness, but the legislature has defined how we are going to submit people under Chapter 33. And they have recognized in their brief the reason why we don't have, the innocent members of the public don't have to prove that but for the sale of alcohol, this crash would have never happened is because it will be well nearly impossible to show.
This is a little like, I'm hearing your argument, a little like my question to you about Smith versus Sewell. You say we were done a disservice. We didn't consider what we should have considered. The factual situations are totally different, but you won't say it's wrong. And you say here that Chapter 33 applies, it just doesn't require anything.
I don't believe I ever said it was not wrongly decided. No. We believe that the court erred in finding first-party liability, but that's not governing this case.
You say Chapter 33 applies, it just doesn't mean, it just does not affect the case.
Chapter 33 would apply if there were more than one driver who contributed to cause this crash. The dram shop would only be liable for the actions of its drunken customer and not the actions of any other party who was a cause of the crash. But we don't submit, and juries can't submit. And I would ask this question of my opposing counsel. How would a jury ever submit, apportion?
How can you sit here and say a drunk driver is not a cause of the act?
He's the sole cause, Judge. I'm sorry.
But he is a cause within the meaning of this language.
His intoxication
is the
sole.
The fact that the dram shop is also liable does not take him out of causation, though.
He's the only cause, Justice Owen. I misspoke if I said that he's not the cause. In every case, the intoxication of the patron is the cause of the crash. What I'm saying is we don't submit the dram shop as a percentage.
Well, what if the dram shop is factually a cause, that its sale of the alcohol is the reason that puts this person over the top? He's intoxicated, but he's got some measure of control. Mm-hmm. But they sell alcohol, and the customer consumes it, and that's what makes him completely unable to control his actions. Then would the dram shop be submitted?
They wouldn't be liable, Your Honor, because they would not have sold to him at a time when he was already intoxicated and obviously dangerous.
No, I'm saying that he is, assume that there are distinctions that can be made. Somebody is obviously intoxicated, but that person has demonstrated an ability to get down the road. But you sell and put him over 2.5 or 0.025 or, to such an extent that there is just no ability whatsoever for him to even know where he is, control any in any respect. Would that be sufficient to submit the dram shop?
No, the legislature decided in its policymaking prerogative that Texas would enact a dram shop statute like Iowa, Alaska, that did not require the plaintiff to show that the additional alcohol caused the crash, because that would very nearly be impossible, because under our statute,
those are two different inquiries, aren't they? It's one thing to say you don't have to show that one drink put him over the line or two drinks put him over the line, but it's another to say you're completely substituting in the dram shop for the drunk driver.
The dram shop, under our statute, Justice Owen, does not cause the crash in any way. The plaintiff need not show that, because that would be unscrambling an egg.
Now, I agree with you. You don't have to show the unscrambling of the egg. That's a different inquiry from saying you completely substitute the liability of the driver in the dram shop, totally subsumes the liability of the driver.
Well, when we talk about the language the legislature used in describing the statute, that is that they're liable for the acts of their customers, that's exactly what that means. We can use terms like direct liability. In other words, the legislature has used terms in 6132, the partnership statutes, having vicarious liability of the partners for the other partners. We have it in joint and several. We have it in master and servant. The words the legislature used here simply says plainly that this act provides for liability of the alcohol sellers for the actions of their customers. Their argument here is plain and simple, and let's be straight here. They want to argue the opposite. They want to say we're only liable for our own acts and our own percentage. We are not liable for the drunk's conduct.
Let me ask you, Mr. Griffin, let me see if I understand your
your argument. Under Chapter 33, what you are submitting is blanks for the jury to assess who's the percentage of their causation of the event. It says percentage of responsibility, but it's defined in terms of a person causing or contributing to cause. So you put a percentage in there. If the Dram Shop Act imputes the driver's causation element, they sell the alcohol to a person they know is drunk, then Chapter 2, the Dram Shop Act, imputes the driver's causation to the dram shop for the damage that they cause. It would not make sense under the proportionate responsibility statute to put two blanks for causation, because by definition under the dram shop, the causation of the driver is imputed to them. So it would come out 100% because you impute the causation of the driver. If you try to submit, you shook your head. Because it's the causation element of the driver that's imputed to the dram shop, under the Dram Shop Act, it would not make sense to submit a proportionate responsibility question to the jury, because a proportionate responsibility is supposed to be assessed on the jury's determination of the percentage of that person's act that was a cause of the injury.
Here, Mr. Ruiz, the drunken patron.
That's right. But the Chapter 33 is a very broad statute. It says you're going to be submitting blanks on proportionate responsibility even where the jury is not determining the same types of causation. It has products liability. It has negligence. It has any other activity that violates an applicable legal standard and any combination of these. And so the blanks wouldn't necessarily, the causation percentages in those blanks wouldn't necessarily be representative of actual causation. It might be a percentage of producing cause. It might be percentage of proximate cause. It might be some sort of other causation standard the legislature determines. So isn't the language of Chapter 33 broad enough to anticipate that the dram shop would be submitted as well? Even if, as you say, we're imputing causation, because the Chapter 33 isn't dependent on a similarity of causations.
Well, the only problem I see with Your Honor's question is the barrier to that is the statute, because the statute takes the term and the factors the jury considers in apportioning. It's not based upon culpability or the different types of conduct. What Your Honor has said was the different types of conduct are ones that are encompassed in the statute. That doesn't help us in answering the questions that once we determine that this cause of action is under the statute, who is submitted. They carefully chose the language causing or contributed to cause and rejected legislative language that would allow apportionment on other methods other than causation. They rejected that and stuck with causation as the definition. And just think, and I think that they have a duty to the bench and to the bar to explain to this court and to the other courts of this state how it would work to try to apportion between imputed cause, which they admit on page 7 of their brief on the merit, the causation of the drunk is imputed to them 100%, how a jury would ever apportion between the imputed cause and the real cause. The drunk's intoxication was the 100% cause of this terrible crash, and that causation, in their brief, is imputed to them. How would a jury ever intelligently answer a question like that in light of the legislature's definition?
Well, not there's a middle ground. Seems to me, I mean, they're saying no liability, you're saying 100%. It seems like there's still a middle ground in there for contribution purposes. That even though the dram shop may still be liable for 100% of the damages to the injured third party, as between the drunk and the dram shop, there can be a apportionment for contribution purposes.
Well, we have to be careful, because they have that cause of action pending right now in Calhoun County against the drunk. That cause of action was severed. They haven't been harmed. It's sitting there. Whatever right of contribution they have, they still have. What this court
did. Why is it more judicially economical to decide all in one case? It doesn't change anything. No matter what the jury puts in the blank, the plaintiff recovers that amount from the dram shop. But as between the driver and the dram shop for contribution purposes, we've got one trial, we've got one jury, they answer the blank, and we're done.
Trouble is the drunk did not take that position. The drunk did not object to severing it. I'm letting them ferret out their fight how they want to.
I'm just asking not this case, but what's wrong with that from we're looking at the statutes, statutory scheme, what's wrong with that view of the statute?
Well, in some cases, it may be more efficient for them to ferret out their fight in the main case. But here, the drunk didn't object to it. They're not harmed. Whatever cause of action they have against the drunk, whether it be in the manner you suggested, Justice Owen, or what Justice O'Neill suggested earlier, that right they have, they still have. Today, as we sit here and as we go home,
you're saying the statute doesn't allow them to do that. I'm saying that we disagree with you. It doesn't. Forget this case. I'm talking about statutory construction that does not prohibit a trial court from doing it that way. Does it?
Keeping it in the main case and letting them ferret out there.
Yes.
No, absolutely not. In fact, most of the case law is that the court has some discretion in severances to determine those questions. And so, sure, I think in the abstract, away from this case, this certainly could have been done that way. But one final thing, they have not pled indemnity against their drunk here. It's not in the case at all. They never made a pleading of indemnity. They did have a pleading of contribution, and they have every right they ever had still sitting in their lawsuit against Roberto Ruiz today.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McMaines.
Yes, Your Honor.
The argument, as I understand Mr. Griffin makes, is that the proportionate responsibility statute, what you ask the jury to answer in their blanks is their assessment of the percentage of causation, essentially. To each person's causing or contributing to cause, you have to put a percentage as to that. If causation under the statute, dram shop, is imputed from the driver to the dram shop, how does a jury determine, as between those two, the percentages of causation?
Your Honor, that position is fundamentally erroneous, which is what we have argued and tried to establish in the brief. What the tort reform statute did in 1987, the same time, the same legislative session, passed the dram shop statute, is they repudiated the comparative causation analysis in Duncan and substituted a comparative responsibility analysis by terms of the statute. And the percentage of responsibility that is included in the statute is defined as including any violation of any legal standard, and they are talking about the responsibility to be assessed. Now, the idea that there's going to be an all-or-nothing type answer is not borne out by the cases themselves. In Borneman versus Steak and Ale, jury compared everybody's conduct. They assessed percentages on everybody's conduct.
Let me ask you, let's suppose you're an employer, and the employer supplied an employee with alcohol and allowed the employee to drive home. And then you have an employer who's going to be, during the course and scope of work, or to drive to, during the drive, not to home, but to another place of business, during the day. You're going to have the employer's negligence, you're going to have the employee's negligence, and there's clearly vicarious liability in that situation. How does the statute, how does comparative responsibility work?
In regards to an injury to a third person?
Third person.
Well, there actually is no, I think, under this court's decision in Love, I don't believe that there's actually any liability for providing the alcohol.
Unless
they're a license.
That was independent contract. This is clearly employee-employer during the course and scope.
On a pure course and scope issue.
Pure course
if
and scope.
If all the liability to the employer is imputed based on the course and scope issue, then there's not a separate percentage submission because there is, by definition, in vicarious liability, an imputation of all of their responsibility. By virtue of the stacks, that is the relationship of employer, employee, agent, principal, and so on, all of those things within the scope of the agency, within the scope of the master-servant relationship, those from a status standpoint are in fact vicariously determined and do in fact result in indemnity. It's true we didn't plead any indemnity rights, but we don't have any indemnity rights. We are, by virtue of the statute, the dram shop statute, a joint tortfeasor.
Yeah, Mr.
McMahon, that's what the statute does. Joint tortfeasor status, and we're not entitled to indemnity. You're not entitled to, it's not a vicarious liability issue. It's an imputation of causation based on the individual.
I want to go back to an imputation causation. I use the word causation because I don't know how else to describe it. And I understand the statute was amended getting away from comparative causation, comparative responsibility.
Correct.
But that was to assure that when you had different standards of causation, you could submit to the comparative responsibility, where you had producing cause versus proximate cause. But the statute specifically says that when you're assessing this percentage of responsibility, it's with respect to each person's causing or contributing to cause in any way the harm for which recovery of damages is sought. So they're going to be measuring this responsibility to the extent that what they're doing is causing or contributed to cause. Now, if you impute whatever the responsibility of the dram shop is, you impute to them 100% of the activity contributing to the cause, how does the jury evaluate the relative responsibilities if the statute imputes the element of what caused?
There is no imputation of 100%. There is an imputation of the fact of proximate cause based by virtue of the statutory definition.
So you would instruct, when you give this instruction to the jury, you would say by statute, you're not going to be asked whether or not this caused any injury. You're going to say, did they serve him? Was he drunk? Now, what's the proportion of responsibility? What part of that was that contributing to the accident? You would expect that to be the jury to decide this percentage based on what part of that contributed to the accident. The
percentage of responsibility issue has been decided in all of the other cases that have ever come to this court on those issues. The Ventulius case decided that. Borneman versus Steak and Ale case. They all were cases in which there is a percentage of responsibility both submitted and answered. And there are percentages, in fact, assessed against everybody. It is for the jury to determine, and the definition of percentage of responsibility is, in fact, determined in functional terms, in terms of what percentage the jury writes down. And that's the limitations of liability. And the idea of limiting our rights to contribution is to impose a joint and several liability obligation in excess of what the statute on its face does in violation of Chapter 2 of the Alcohol and Beverage Code.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.